Okay, just start generally, I think, with your own background.
Yes, okay.
How did you get into the astronomical field?
Reading a book when I was six. My mother was always interested in astronomy, and she had some books on it, and at the age of six I found one and picked it up and started to read it, and thought this was interesting, so I went on. And it became a great hobby of mine. I got interested in the moon particularly, and I was actually publishing some papers about the moon's surface when I was in my teens. And then, of course, I along came university years, but also a gentleman named Hitler appeared on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I had all my papers signed up for Cambridge, but it wasn't quite the right moment. Therefore, I chucked that up and got into the Air Force and flew things around for the war. And at the end of the war, I obviously wanted to go to university, but I just missed it. I mean, I just started before I went there. And I couldn't do it without taking a government grant. And government grants are not in my line. So I decided then I would take a job, sort of work around, do a bit of writing, and pay my way through university. I never had time to do it, because things, the skids were put under me. I never actually had time to do it. So I was very kindly given an honorary doctorate eventually, but my DSC is on what I've got.
I see. How do you get involved in the media, should we say?
Again, I'm not entirely certain. What happened was, during the 1950s, in my own particular subject, the moon, my first book, which is still in print, it's umpteenth edition, was called Guide to the Moon. And I was doing some moon mapping. I got involved in the various American projects. And at some stage in the 1950s, I was invited to do a broadcast, and I forget now what it was about. It was unscripted anyway. And I went on to do this broadcast, and Paul Johnston, the television producer, now dead alas, happened to hear it. And he was looking around for someone to do a regular program on astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
Having heard me doing this, thought I might be the man to have a go at it. So he said, would you like to start a program called The Sky at Night? And we'll just give it three programs to see how it goes. Well, that was in April 1957, and we're still going.
Yeah. So it was as simple as that?
As simple as that. I mean, the reason why I've been broadcasting once a month now, regularly, without missing any, for the last 25 years, very nearly,
mm-hmm.
is simply that I was in the right place at the right time. You see, I began The Sky at Night in April 1957, mm-hmm. and in October 1957, up went Sputnik 1, Russia's yes. first satellite. So when the space age began, I was just the man in possession, which is why I've stayed there, simply as simple as that.
I see. Sort of fairly simply, so that, you know, sort of the non-astronomical reader can understand it, how do you see the space situation as it has progressed so far?
Well, the space situation has progressed very much more rapidly than anyone could have expected. I remember way back in 1939, just before the war, at a meeting of the British Astronomical Association, giving my view that I thought there would be artificial satellites by 1960 and men on the moon between 1980 and 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And a very famous astronomer was overheard to say, these youngsters have got strange ideas, haven't they? And I reminded him of that only the other day. He had the grace to grin. Certainly, I knew space satellites were going to go. I think we all did. I thought then they'd be American first, because I was wrong when they were Russian. And so far as the moon was concerned, that we'd reached the moon, well, Arthur Clarke got it right. He was saying about 1970, and I was about 10 to 15 years too pessimistic. But I was of the right order, and most people were not. Certainly, I think we've got to admit with great regret that had it not been for the war, we wouldn't have got this far in space research. Was there's no doubt at all that the genius behind the space research program, in America anyway, was Wernher von Braun, who of course was the man who was one of the main designers of the V2 weapons used against England in the last stage of the war. Although luckily at one stage Hitler had him arrested for concentrating too much on the moon and not enough on weaponry, which was very lucky for us. And of course the interesting thing there is, we'll see how silly it is, we bombed Peenemünde at the war and did quite a lot of damage there. We knew where the installations were. And I might have been on that bombing raid. In point of fact, I wasn't. I was somewhere, out over Norway then, I think. But I might have been on that bombing raid quite easily. In fact, I wasn't. That was in 1944, or 45, I forget now. And in 1947, Werner and I were having a very amicable dinner together in New York on first name terms. Shows how silly it is.
Yeah.
So far as the manned space research is concerned, of course, so much is dependent upon the shuttle. And that's now been successful, in this first flight anyway. The Russians have got their space station techniques down to a fine art, and of course the Americans have got their unmanned probes out as far as Saturn now.
Yeah.
So progress has been very great, and I think in the next few years we're going to see major orbital bases, a large space telescopes launched, and a whole laboratory put into orbit. I think men will probably go back to the moon about 1990, and with any luck we should have a lunar base before 2000.
Mm-hmm. How important do you see the recent space shuttle?
Absolutely vital. Because if that had gone wrong, the American program would have been put back for 10, 20 years at least. Mm-hmm. It was an absolutely vital, integral part of the American program of Man in Space. So thank goodness it has worked successfully, quite apart from the human element.
And how do you see it progressing in the future? First of all, in terms of the space shuttle.
Well, you see, the point is what the space shuttle is going to do, it really is a space taxi. Mm-hmm. It's going to be used to take people up and down to space, and also to the major orbital bases that are bound to be built now, I think, within the next few years. Mm-hmm. And without the space shuttle, the recoverable spaceship, you can't really have these big orbital bases. So that's really where the main value comes in.
I see. And what about progress in general? Are we going to have a man on Mars by the year 2000?
No, I don't think so. You see, the point is that Mars is a very different proposition from the Moon. If things go wrong on a lunar flight, you can more or less turn around and come back, which is what Apollo 13 did.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite so simple as that. They had to coast around the Moon, but that was what it meant. Well, if you're on the way to Mars and something goes wrong, there's no way in which you can come back.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the journey is going to take weeks instead of a few hours. So the associated minor problems, I mean, food and water supply, and above all, weightlessness, they become anything but minor. And I would say that technically, we could probably put a man on Mars by the year 2010, 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it will be done as early as that is quite another matter, and it may not be. And there's one very uncertain factor still. We know that man can stay in space for periods of several months without being adversely affected, at least not much.
Yeah.
But when you're going on a journey to Mars lasting months, a period on Mars under very reduced gravity, only one third Earth's, and then another journey back, whether the human frame is going to like that is another matter.
Mm-hmm. What about life on Mars?
As you know, the two Viking probes have landed there,
mm-hmm.
and they've analysed the soil. And I think it's fair to say that we expected to find not intelligent life or advanced life.
Yeah.
We did expect to find organic matter anyway, very primitive organisms, and we haven't. The experiments are a bit contradictory, but there's nothing in them that can't be explained by a chemical reaction. So at the moment we can only say that if there is any life on Mars, we haven't found it yet.
It's very primitive.
It's very primitive, and of course don't forget there are only two Vikings on Mars, only looked in two places.
Yeah.
So we may have looked in the wrong place. It may be of a kind we can't detect. It may be the experiments are wrong. All I can say is that most of the people who are now involved in the Viking missions, they are coming to the very reluctant conclusion that probably there isn't any life on Mars. And if there is any at all, it's very lowly.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about it, where the Viking probes have landed. If you landed, if a man from Mars, say, landed a probe in the middle of the Sahara Desert and another one in the middle of the Antarctic, he wouldn't find any life there either.
Well, I think he would. From great respect, he would.
He would.
The point is, I mean, even the soil of the Sahara is not entirely sterile.
I see.
You get a certain amount of reaction shown. But I quite agree that those two areas on Mars, they were selected by a team, which I was a member, actually.
Mm-hmm.
They were selected with great care, and they looked promising. But, of course, we may have looked in the wrong place, and of course it may be that Martian life is just very peculiar.
Mm-hmm. Would you say it's very unlikely to find life on any other planet?
In the solar system, I'm quite sure they won't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at them. I mean, Mercury's got virtually no atmosphere and it's too hot.
Mm-hmm.
Venus, totally unsuitable. The dense atmosphere, you can't breathe. Corrosive clouds, all kinds of things wrong with Venus.
Mm-hmm.
The giants haven't even got solid surfaces. Their satellites are all too cold. The only one that's got an atmosphere is Titan.
Mm-hmm.
And Pluto is just a chunk of ice.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in our own solar system, life is confined to the Earth, the only loophole being possibly, I suppose, a very primitive Martian organism, which we've not found yet.
Mm-hmm. And the possibility of exploring other solar systems?
Other solar systems by rocket or by any means we know at the moment. But if you believe Einstein, and almost everybody does, certainly mm-hmm. I do, then you can't travel at the velocity of light.
Yeah.
So you've got to go slower than that. So journeys to the stars are going to take an impossibly long time. You can't do it. Therefore, if we're going to reach other solar systems, you've got to use some method about which we know absolutely nothing at the moment, and therefore nothing to speculate. All right, when you start talking about things like teleportation and thought travel, well, that's Star Wars and Doctor Who. I mean, that is sheer science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But as I've often said before, and I'll say again in my talk tonight, television would have been the science fiction to King Knieve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Science fiction often becomes science fact.
Just to sort of get a fact into the interview, if we were to travel to the nearest solar system, other than ours, how long would it take to get there, approximately?
Well, I'm not trying to be funny, it depends how fast you go.
If you say went at 90% of the speed of light.
Well, I'd say this, the nearest stars, which are even remotely like the Sun, are two called Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani. Mm-hmm. And they're both a rather smaller and cooler than the Sun, but they have solar type. And their distance is just over 11 light years. So if you go at the velocity of light, you'll be 11 years on the way. Of course, that's quite out of the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting to think about anyway.
Yes.
And what about yourself? What other hobbies do you have other than...
I've got plenty of hobbies. So in the astronomical field, of course, I'm an observer of the moon and planets, essentially, always have. Mm-hmm. Other hobbies? Music is one. I enjoy doing that.
What sort of music?
I'm a middle brow. I like some classical music, not all of it by a long way. Mm-hmm. I don't like pop music, I confess. I'm what I call a tunesmith. When asked where I belong, I always say I'm a genuine member of the Johann Strauss Society, and that places mm-hmm. me. The only thing that I will play in public is the xylophone. Mm-hmm. And I had great fun last December, and I actually played with them at the Festival Hall, the London Philharmonic. That was great fun. Mm-hmm. And I've written quite a bit of music here and there, and I actually had a record out last year of stuff I'd written. But I'm a complete charlatan. I never had a lesson in my life. That's one hobby. I'm a cricketer. Mm-hmm. Even at my advanced age of 58, I still play regularly. I still get my wickets, I'm glad to say.
What sort of team do you play for?
I play for two teams. I play for my village, which I'm secretary of the local village club.
Which is where?
Selsey in Sussex. Mm-hmm. And I'm also a Lord's Taverner. So I get quite a bit of cricket and sign when I have time. Mm-hmm. I'm the worst batsman in the world on an appalling field. I'm purely a spin bowler. I blow my leg breaks at medium pace or a long leaping kangaroo hop run, which is quite characteristic. I'm a chess player, I play chess a lot also. Mm-hmm. Well, not so much now, but I used to. All kinds of things all that, but I get mixed up in. Mm-hmm. Actually, don't put this in the paper, I'm rather heavily mixed up with handicapped kids, which takes a lot of time.
But maybe that would be a good thing to put in the paper, especially in the year of disabled.
Well, I'm mixed up with that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
What about Kiel? You've seen our observatory. What do you think about it?
I think I was there at the opening of it. It's one of the best university observatories I've seen. I have no actual professional association with Kiel, except that Dr. Madison, whom you know very well, is a very old friend of mine. Mm-hmm. I've known him for many years, and I know a lot of people at Kiel, so I've been in and out, so to speak. But I have mm-hmm. no official link with it at all.
I see. What other facilities do we have here?
Well, so far, because I'm concerned entirely the astronomical side, I know your mm-hmm. physical laboratory is very fine, I'm sure the others are too. But in the astronomy section, you've got that very fine old refractor that came from Oxford, mm-hmm. that's really a splendid telescope, and you've got the new 24-inch, which is we're using with a photometer at the moment, mm-hmm. you've got lecture rooms, facilities, and of course good workshops. Mm-hmm. Oh yes, you've got a very fine observatory there, and of course, a good sight. I know we get quite a lot of cloud in these areas, everyone does. You've got a clear horizon and no bad artificial lights.
Mm-hmm. Is that because we're up in the hills?
Partly because you're up in the hills, and of course partly because you're not really near any major complex. So it's the nearest is Stoke, and that's far enough away below the hill not to be a real nuisance. Mm-hmm. Mind you, I think I still rather have my Celsius guys.
How far can we see from our own observatory? What can we see with our equipment, and sort of how well can we see it? Can we say get a good definition on Mars?
Oh yes, the old refractor is very good for that indeed. Of course the big refractor, 24 inch, isn't normally used for lunar and planetary work mm-hmm. because it does other things, it's sort of further into space. But I've used that old telescope, actually not here, I did when I was at Oxford. Mm-hmm. And I've used it there, and it's a very, very good telescope indeed for planetary definition.
What about Saturn? Because everyone at the moment is interested in Saturn's rings.
Yes, Saturn's rings. You see those pretty well at the 12-inch. I've seen them quite a bit this year. I was over in the Airship Propulsion Laboratory last November when the pictures mm-hmm. were coming through. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at Saturn through my own telescope, which is a 15-inch reflector. Mm-hmm. And you get pretty good definition.
Is the evidence that we're getting from Saturn very important? I saw a television programme about it, I'm sure. Quite a few of our readers have, where they're sort of seeing more and more rings and getting more and more information about the rings. Is that an important thing to do?
It is indeed, and it's upset many of our cherished theories. We were so confident we knew what caused the main division of the ring, Cassini's division, which you can see very nicely with the telescope here on the Saturn's well placed. And of course it can't be, it isn't that at all, because we thought this was due to the influence of the satellites of Saturn, so every time a particle went into the ring, into the gap, it was yanked out again. Well, you can work it back with one division, or even two, not with about 100. So there's something very different there. And we're learning more about that and more all the time, about planets in general, because that leads on to a better understanding of our own Earth.
I see. Let's just take for a moment the example of the layman, say someone like myself. Obviously at Kiel you can join the Astronomy Society, go and look from the observatory, but if you don't have facilities like that, what can the layman do at home? How can you work up an interest in
When I was a kid, the first thing I said, I did some reading and got the background of it, and then the advice I give everybody, go outside on a clear night with a star map and identify the stars. They become so much more interesting when you learn which is which. And if you want to take up astronomy as a hobby, there's no need to go into buying a large and expensive telescope. And in fact, I wouldn't advise anyone to buy a telescope of the £30 to £40 range. But you get the small Japanese refractors for that. In fact, I wouldn't touch them. Unless you're prepared to pay something like £100 to £150 for a 3-inch refractor, a 6-inch reflector or larger, I would make do with good binoculars, say 7x50s, which will show you a great deal, endless star fields, star clusters, nebulae, coloured stars, the phases of Venus, the moons of Jupiter, mountains and craters on the moon. It'll show you a great deal. And I think these binoculars are rather better normally than these small Japanese small refractors, because they're much less difficult to use, and they've got most of the advantages of a small telescope, apart from sheer magnification. Now, many years ago, when I was young, it is a long time ago now, astronomy was regarded as a kind of way out subject. Well, it isn't. It never was, really, and it's even less so now, because these days you can't separate astronomy from physics, chemistry, mechanics, mathematics, of course, even medicine these days. You can't separate astronomy from those. All these branches of science are coming together. And in learning more about astronomy, we're also learning more about other branches of science.
How are we learning more about medicine?
Space medicine. After all, they're very anxious to know indeed just how spacemen, astronauts, react to conditions under zero gravity, what the radiation effects are. And when we get onto the surface of the moon, well, they're seeing how the human heart reacts under conditions of very reduced G over a long time. It's going to be very useful to heart specialists. Also, the best way of treating cancer is by radiation. You want to study all the radiations coming from space. You've got to go above the atmosphere, because so many of them are blocked up by the atmospheric layers. So there's a very close link there. No question about that. Now, obviously, if you try and separate astronomy from physics and maths, say, all right, well, can you separate arithmetic from algebra? And of course you can't.
So, would you say that astronomy is causing breakthroughs in other fields of science to a greater degree than other fields of science have caused breakthroughs in astronomy or
after? I wouldn't differentiate between the two. After all, when you're talking about the nuclear fusion and nuclear fission, for example, the power of the nuclear reactions in general, well, where's the biggest nuclear reaction near at hand? Answer: the sun. And without the sun, we know a great deal less about the behavior of the atom, therefore the peaceful uses of atomic power, than we actually do. Looking back over the astronomy of the last 20 years, it's amazing in some ways how right we were and how wrong we were in others. For example, when it comes onto the moon's surface, I modestly claim that what I've been saying for a great many years, I mean, right back to my young days, has turned out to be correct. And I think I got the moon right. And now we come to the planet Venus, which wasn't at all right. We were, many of us, including myself, followed a theory in America by Whipple and Menzel that the clouds were probably heavily water charged, and that the surface was probably completely covered with water, and therefore Venus might be a kind of supertropical world where life in the oceans might have begun. And of course it's not like that at all. It's totally hostile to any form of life. So with Venus we were completely wrong. And we were wrong in many respects on Mars, because most people, including myself again, thought there was a kind of flattish surface there, gently undulating. We didn't expect the mountains, the craters, and above all the volcanoes. And of course, when looking at the Galileo satellites of Jupiter, who would have thought there would be active volcanoes on Io? So we've been wrong in many ways, but quite right in others. There's another point too. I said earlier, I've been doing these Sky at Night programs of mine for the last 25 years, which is very nearly true, it was 25 years in April. And when I started, things like quasars, pulsars, black holes, centaurs, all these things were completely unknown. They weren't even suspected. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the astronomy over 25 years has changed out of all recognition. Could never get in those days, too. The idea of reaching the moon was still rather officially laughed at in some quarters. I've got a book in my possession, dated 1923, and I've got an earlier edition, dated 1913, 10 years between the two. And when you compare them, well, the changes are minimal. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't really bother which edition I had. But in 1981, a book written in 1971 is completely out of date. Mm-hmm. I know, in 1978, I'd spent about 3 years working on a big book on astronomy called The Guinness Book of Astronomy Facts and Feats, a kind of companion to the famous Guinness Book of Records, you know. Mm-hmm. And that book took me about 3 years to write, and it came out and it was published about 18 months ago. And I can see that next year I've got to start the job of revising it.
Mm-hmm. I see. You've reminded me of something there. Things like black holes, in what light do you see them?
I don't see them at all, they're quite invisible.
Well, you were going to say how...
Well, these, of course, well, you can't see black holes. All you can do is to identify them by their effects upon things you can see. Mm-hmm. And that, again, was a concept which hadn't been thought of. Not seriously. In theory it had, but there was no thought of detecting these things until very recent times. And, of course, other things too. X-ray astronomy hadn't begun in 1957. Mm-hmm. You can't do that from down here. Neither can you gamma-ray astronomy, because the X-rays and gamma rays coming into the space are blocked up by the upper atmosphere. Well, that's true of the X-ray, not entirely true of the gamma rays, I try to be. But X-ray astronomy certainly has to be done from above the atmosphere. We're all looking forward to the large space telescopes which usually launched in the mid-1980s. Mm-hmm. It'll be a great thing.
Yes, I mean, I've seen so-called studies where they imagine that if you try to go into a black hole, you might sort of come out in a different...
Yes, I know, come out in a different universe or in another part of ours. Well, all these very exotic ideas, I must confess, I am a bit sceptical. Mm-hmm. No one really knows. Well, anyone ever will know, I can't tell.
Mm-hmm. What about things that sort of, if you like, directly could affect all of us, like meteors and comets and that sort of thing?
Asteroid collision, interesting, you know. But the not the next Sky at Night, which is going to be the planet Neptune, but the one after that, was the one after that, when you have within the next 3 months, mm-hmm. we're going to do a program about precisely that, mm-hmm. asteroid and cometary collisions. The answer is it does happen sometimes, mm-hmm. but the chance of anyone being damaged by a falling chunk of stuff from space are negligible. Mm-hmm. And throughout the whole of recorded history, there's no certain case of anyone having been killed by a falling meteorite. Mm-hmm. So don't worry.
What about a comet or something like that?
Well, the only cometary collision we probably had in recent years was the 1908 thing that hit Siberia. Mm-hmm. And that blue pine tree flapped for a long distance around. That was probably only because of a small comet. But I think a comet is the most insubstantial thing, made up chiefly of ice.
I see.
So there was no...
So it's like to break up in
yes,
the ice.
Yes, it is.
I see. Are there any other things that might come whizzing
not
towards
really.
Us?
Not really. Not really. Asteroids. But of course, mind you, if we did have a major hit from an asteroid or a very large meteorite or a nucleus of a comet, mm-hmm. it did hit a city, the death toll would be very high indeed. Mm-hmm. But there's no evidence it's ever happened, and the chances are vanishing. Mm-hmm.
On the assumption that we're not hit by some sort of massive flying object that sort of destroys all of us, and on the assumption that we don't blow ourselves up within the next...
Ah, yes, that's the dangerous one.
...next few years. How long have we got?
5,000 million years or so, until the sun changes drastically. And if we have any sense, we can go on for that length of time. But whether we're going to destroy ourselves is something that neither I nor anyone else at the moment knows. Mm-hmm. Certainly I don't like the look of the situation. Mm-hmm. The ironical thing is, all we really need is literally half a dozen strong, honest statesmen spread throughout the world, and we'd probably be all right. Mm-hmm. If you look around for them at the moment, I'm afraid you aren't going to find them. Mm.
And what sort of strong, honest statesmen do you mean?
I think we're getting into rather non-astronomical waters here, but the whole point is, of course, there's plenty of room on Earth for us. Mm-hmm. And if we chose the right leaders, it would not lead us into stupid wars. mm-hmm. then we could make the Earth a pleasant place indeed. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why we shouldn't. But I just wonder whether every civilization of the galaxy, and other galaxies, wherever it may be, gets to the stage we've got to now, where it's got this scientific know-how to destroy itself, and hasn't got the civilization not to. I'm going with which is the norm, that people get to that stage and then blow themselves up.
Mm-hmm. And therefore no one does end up whizzing around the universe and visiting everyone else.
Yeah.
Do you believe that there could be intelligent life on other planets that are capable of coming to Earth and having a little look around?
I find that very difficult to answer. I'm sure there's plenty of intelligent life in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
But I said earlier on, if we're going to get to the stars, you've got to use some entirely unknown method.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're coming into science fiction. Now, it may be science fiction. It may be something that is literally impossible. Mm-hmm. And if that is so, then no race in the universe will ever be able to do it, and there never will be any contact.
Mm-hmm.
All I will say is that if it's going to be done at all, it's got to be done by some method entirely unknown to us.
Mm-hmm.
And whether any other race has got to that stage is anybody's guess. The only thing I will say is that there is no evidence that we have been visited yet. But don't forget also that mankind has been going for a very short time in the history of the universe.